The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
This episode is brought to you by my friend Rebecca Walzer. Rebecca is a financial expert who can help you protect your wealth during this volatile market. Book your complimentary call with her team by going to friendofdinesh.com. Now, coming up today, well, later, 8 p.m. Eastern, I've got my Locals Q&A that you can find that at dinesh.locals.com. And here I'm going to be talking about the Supreme Court's, well, I guess their fourth major decision. This one authorizes a football coach to pray on the field after a game. I'm going to hit back at leftist critiques of the SCOTUS decision overturning Roe versus Wade. I'm also going to talk about another somewhat ignored decision by the Supreme Court, this one affecting voter ID in North Carolina. And author John Stadden is going to join me. We're going to talk about his new book, Science in an Age of Unreason. This is the Dinesh D'Souza Show.
Needs this voice. The times are crazy. In a time of confusion, division, and lies, we need a brave voice of reason, understanding, and truth. This is the Dinesh D'Souza Podcast.
Not surprisingly, the focus on the Supreme Court has been on the overturning of Roe versus Wade, a stunning decision with momentous consequences. So that's very understandable. But there have been some other important decisions I want to focus on in today's podcast as well. I'll also be talking about Roe. But I want to begin by talking about the new decision, Kennedy versus Bremerton, in which a coach, Joe Kennedy, had been disciplined by the school, this is Bremerton, for praying on the field. Now, he wasn't leading a prayer. He wasn't calling the fans down. He wasn't even assembling the whole team. He was just doing it by himself. But the school decided we can't allow that because it's going to be seen as if we, the school, endorse a particular type of religious expression. So the school, in a sense, was sort of reading the Constitution on its own and saying there's a no establishment clause in the Constitution. This no establishment clause appears to create a wall between church and state. We, being a public school, are part of the state, and so we can't endorse any particular religious view. It's not even clear that the school was, quote, anti-religious. The school just thought that it couldn't violate the Constitution in this way. And so this goes before the Supreme Court. Now, let's remember that in the First Amendment, putting aside for a moment the free speech clause, there are two clauses that deal with religion, and they appear to conflict with each other, but they really don't. The reason they don't is because, the reason they appear to conflict with each other is because we have a wrong reading of one of the two clauses. And so that puts it in tension with the other one. The first clause is that we are allowed free expression of religion. That cannot be curtailed. It cannot be blocked by any law or by Congress. The other is that Congress cannot pass any law respecting an establishment of religion. That's the phrasing, respecting an establishment of religion. Now, notice that that's really quite different from separation of church and state. Here's an article, I think this is CNN. The decision lowers the bar between church and state. First of all, there's no bar between church and state. This whole idea of a wall between church and state is a fiction. The no establishment clause means exactly what it says. The state cannot establish in the sense of consecrate. Well, I mean, we don't need esoteric readings of words here. There are countries that have established religions. England is one of them. They have an established Anglican church. And so the state endorses certain religious ceremonies while, of course, affording tolerance to to others. We had in this country, in the early days of the Republic, states that had established religions. The Anglican religion over here, the Presbyterians over there, the Congregationalists over here, and so on. So this was religious establishment. By the way, notice the Constitution doesn't say states can't do it. It says Congress can't do it. But the meaning of establishment is really clear. And so what happens here is that Gorsuch writes an opinion basically saying, listen, when we look at what this coach is doing, there is no issue of religious establishment because the coach is not acting on behalf of the school. This is not the school taking sides. This is the coach taking sides. And what is the coach taking sides with? What is he, in a sense, engaged in? Well, he's engaged in, obviously, a expression of his own religious beliefs. And this brings us to the other clause in the Constitution, which is, of course, the free expression, the freedom of conscience, the ability for him to exercise his religious beliefs as he sees fit. In other words, what the court is really doing is applying a certain measure of contextual reading of the situation. And that is, in context, the coach is doing nothing more than expressing himself in a religious way. And kind of what the court is saying is, listen, these religious expressions cannot be curtailed any different than any other kind of expression. So let's say, for example, the coach said something like, I am against racism. And he says that on the field. Again, he's not leading the audience in a chant. He's not even leading his team in a chant. He's expressing himself. Well, the school wouldn't discipline him for doing that. And so the point here is that why are we singling out religious expression as if it is something particularly dangerous about it? Well, from the point of view of the left, they do think it's dangerous. They do think it violates this wall of separation. So, interestingly, the real wall of separation is not between church and state. It's really between the left and the right in this country now in their understanding of the Constitution itself. Here is Sotomayor in a very, let's call it, unself-conscious passage where she basically says something like, you know, the coach's action is making the school into a purveyor of religious indoctrination. And in effect, she says, somewhat comically, the school should really not be in the indoctrination business. And any of us who have been following these schools with their gender insanity, with their racial indoctrination, critical race theory, all the rest of it, pride this and pride that, know that schools have become engines of indoctrination. And so this pious claim, schools have got to be free of indoctrination, coming from Sotomayor, doesn't really persuade at this point. Recently, I announced that Walmart canceled MyPillow. They will no longer be selling Mike's products at their stores. When are retailers going to stop letting the left bully them into submission? Enough is enough. Now, Mike always fires back, and comes out with great products. I'm excited to announce the MyPillow sandals. Summer is here, and you'll need some waterproof sandals to go to the beach and the pool. These sandals aren't just practical. They're also super comfortable. We just got some and can't believe how cushiony they are. The regular price of these sandals is $79.98, but now they're on sale for $49.98 with promo code Dinesh. So take advantage of it. Call 800-876-0227, that number, 800-876-0227, or go to mypillow.com. Don't forget to use promo code D-I-N-E-S-H, Dinesh. I've been seeing some very strange reactions from the left in response to the Supreme Court's decision overturning Roe versus Wade, and I want to explore some of those in this segment. One of the common themes I've been hearing is the idea that the Supreme Court must not tell women what to do with their bodies. And what I find kind of interesting about this argument is that this is precisely the Supreme Court's argument in the Dodd decision. The Supreme Court says, we, the Supreme Court, must not tell you what to do with this issue, what to do with your body, what to do with abortion in general. It's not our business. Why? Because the Constitution doesn't recommend abortion. The Constitution neither forbids abortion. And so this is not a matter for the court to decide. There is no right here that has to be defended against state or federal action. This is a democratic matter to be settled democratically. So the court is saying that the court can't tell women what to do with their bodies, but legislatures can. In fact, the left doesn't contest that principle, because if it did, then they would say that the legislature has no right to pass mask mandates because they can't tell people what to do with their bodies. And the legislature has no right to pass vaccine mandates. And the legislature doesn't have the right to do 50 other things that the legislature does do that do tell you what to do and where to go and how to behave and what you can't do and so on, including things that occur in, quote, private, in your own domain. You can't molest your own children in your own house. It doesn't matter how private it is. Bribery is private, but you can't do that. So democratically, all kinds of laws restrict what people can and can't do. And the court is saying abortion's not any different than that. It's something that needs to be decided by states democratically. Now, Whoopi Goldberg, who's apparently very angry at particularly Clarence Thomas, I guess she thinks that it's really bad that he decided this because he's black. And so she basically says that if things keep going the way he wants things to, then she says, quote, Thomas might soon be, quote, back to being a quarter of a person. Now, I think here Whoopi Goldberg is referring to the 3/5 clause of the original Constitution. By the way, that clause has been overridden by subsequent constitutional amendments, but it was there in the original Constitution, by the way. It's no reflection of the intrinsic value of blacks. It arose out of a fight between the North and the South over representation. But nevertheless, there it was in the original Constitution, the 3/5 clause. Whoopi Goldberg doesn't know about it. She doesn't know it's a 3/5 clause. She evidently thinks it's a 1/4 clause. She thinks that somehow the Constitution made blacks into 1/4 of a human being. So this really just shows the kind of intellectual low level that we are dealing with here. And here's Anna Navarro. Quote, if you're against abortion, don't get one. If you're against contraception, don't take any. If you're against same-sex relationships, don't have one. And then she continues, do not impose your beliefs and religion on all Americans. Well, let's test the logic of that claim. Here's my counter to it. If you're against killing people, don't kill anyone. If you're against racial discrimination, don't discriminate. If you don't want to abuse children, don't abuse them. But stop telling others not to do these things. Don't impose your personal moral beliefs on the rest of us. I'm not mentioning this to recommend these things. I'm mentioning this to expose the logical inadequacy of what Anna Navarro is saying. And we find the same kind of reasoning, the same kind of, I'd call it non sequitur, coming from AOC. Here's AOC on the floor. I'm quoting her now. The same individuals who purport claim to be protecting life fight against universal health care. Do they believe in universal health care? From their policy positions, I assure you the evidence is lacking. Now, again, the assumption here is that if you support the protection of life, you are somehow committed to universal health care. You're committed to policy positions in, you may say, the government taking care of that life. Let's test the validity of that logic. Let's say my neighbor is abusing his kids, or let's say he's actually murdering his kids, and I know about it. I'm against it. I want to stop it. I want to take steps to prevent him from either killing or abusing his kids. Now, does it follow that if I take that position, I now have the lifelong responsibility to take care of them myself? Do they automatically now become my kids? I've got to pay for their education. I've got to pay for their healthcare. No. I'm just against them being killed or abused, and I want that stopped. Whether what position I take from there on out, am I willing to help? Am I willing to play a part? That's a whole separate question. So AOC is kind of assuming that you're not sincere in trying to protect life if you're not willing to assume direct responsibility for that life. And I think that is, at the very least, a non sequitur. I'm not coming out against healthcare or anything like that. I'm simply saying it doesn't follow from the one that you are automatically responsible for the other. And here, finally, be sure to set your clocks back 50 years before you go to bed tonight. The idea here, very consistent with progressive rhetoric, that somehow whenever a decision comes out they don't like, we're rolling the clock back. And it's tempting to say we're not, but a better way to answer is this, and that is, you know what? Maybe we should roll the clock back if we could. The clock if we roll the clock back, America 50 years ago, let's see, where was America 50? I guess 1970. I'd rather pick 1980. But America was a better place 50 years ago. We were prosperous. We had free speech. We knew the difference between men and women. We aspired to a colorblind society. The country was much more unified. And so the kind of malevolent creatures like today's Democrats, the kind of people who relish in abortion, take pleasure in abortion, say things like, I'm going to have more pregnancies so I can abort them. That was unthinkable 50 years ago. Are you watching your retirement slip through your hands every day? Are you worried about a black swan market event that is inevitably coming? This is an event that comes out of nowhere and basically decimates your accumulated savings. And that's not all. Interest rates are going up, inflation skyrocketing. How can we protect our money? How can you get ahead of what's happening with the economy? This is not a time to wing it or go with a hunch. You need a qualified expert on your side. Well, I'm not an expert, but my friend Rebecca Walzer is. She's a tax attorney and wealth strategist with her MBA from the London School of Economics. Rebecca and her team can help to prepare you and your money for the turbulent times ahead. We all work hard for our money, and we can use some really good guidance to help us build on what we have. Go to friendofdinesh.com and book your complimentary intro call today to see if you qualify. That's friendofdinesh.com. Let Rebecca Walzer's team of experts protect your wealth during these unprecedented times. I'm continuing my discussion of the left's reaction to the Supreme Court decision overturning Roe versus Wade. In a very peculiar episode, Anna Navarro went on CNN and began to make a list of her family members who are mentally handicapped. She goes, I got a cousin who has Down syndrome. I've got an aunt who has this. And the remarkable implication that she of her comments was, wouldn't it be cool if all these people were aborted? I mean, I don't know any other way to read it because she was talking about abortion. And I think what she was saying is that we as a family have had to support all these characters. And this is a very odd thing to say. In fact, I think it's very unusual for moms who have children with disabilities to take the view that they would be better off dead. And I'm trying to think, why would someone like Anna Navarro even go there? I mean, is there a matter of family inheritance involved? And these people are sort of standing in the way, very insensitive. And even Essie Kupp, who is on CNN with Anna Navarro, who I believe has a child who has some disabilities, she jumped in and goes, this is too much. We can take whatever position we have on abortion, but let's not go here. Now, I'm looking at on social media at one of these demonstrations for abortion. You have a woman. And I'm looking at her right now. She's standing. She seems like a very normal person with a little baseball cap. And she's got two kids. And they look something like 7 and 5. But this is what her sign says. Don't force this on anyone. Don't force this on anyone. Now, I think what she means is don't force pregnancy on anyone. And maybe she did the sign separately and then said to her kids, hey, come with me to the rally. But you can't look at the sign without then looking at her kids. And she seems to be saying, don't force these two menaces on anyone. And you wonder what her kids are going to think about it. I mean, if they grow older and they look at the sign, they're going to go, Mom, what are you saying? What are you saying about us? I don't really know any other way to kind of read that. Here is a remarkable comment by a woman, a very candid comment and to me quite moving. And she says this, I got pregnant at 15, my very first boyfriend. My mom tried to force me into an abortion. I didn't want a baby, but something in me wouldn't let me kill my child. And then the crusher. Today, that same child is mad at me for agreeing with SCOTUS. The child I didn't kill. Lol. So here's a woman talk about irony. She has her own child out of wedlock. It's not a very good time. And her mom goes, abort. She goes, nah, I think I'm going to keep the kid. And the kid is now like, you know, we want Roe versus Wade, not realizing what a close call it was for the kid itself. So what a strange debate we're in. And look, as I think about it, whenever we have these types of political debates, I ask myself, like, who are the good people here? You know, are the good people the people who say, you know, my pregnancy is a mess. It's an inconvenience. I'd rather get my degree. I'd rather go on with my life. Is that the better person that we should all emulate? And then I think about the pro-life people. I think about, think of all the energy that these people have put into this cause for really 50 years. They go to these rallies, they take their rosaries, they go pray. And I'm thinking, what's in it for them? What do they care? You know, normally in politics, when you see someone demonstrating, they always want something. Unions, we want more wages. Employers want, we want tax benefits. Everybody wants some benefit that accrues to themselves in politics. I'm lobbying for the energy industry. But in the pro-life cause alone, you have people who, if they win, get nothing. In fact, in some ways, they're fighting to protect the lives of other people's kids, other people who don't even want them. And I look at some of these leftists and these, you know, I see some of these freaks who are out there protesting and so on, abortion rights. And I'm thinking to myself, do I actually want you to reproduce? Not exactly. I'd be happier if you didn't. I don't exactly think that the kids you bring into the world are going to be probably raised very well, at least not if they end up like you. And yet I'm saying, you know what? I'm still going to fight for you because there's a principle commitment here to life itself. And that's really what motivates these people. That's it. Otherwise, they have nothing to gain. Now, some of them are motivated by religious beliefs, but that my point is the same thing. It's a religious belief in what? In the value and preciousness of human life. Let's notice, by the way, that this is a value that Christianity brought into the world. All you have to do is go to ancient Greece and Rome before Christianity, and you begin to see that this idea that every human life is precious or sacred does not really exist. And we've come to a strange situation. I caused some outrage on social media. I went online and I found a picture of an ultrasound of a puppy. And the puppy was, I don't exactly know what the gestation period is for a dog, but the puppy was sort of in the latter stages of pregnancy, where you can see the full-grown pup. It's right there in the womb. And I say, this is an unborn puppy. It's obviously alive, and it's obviously a puppy. It's not a clump of cells. It's not an extension of its mom. It's not its mom's organ, like the way the mom has a leg or a toe. It has its own organs. It has its own DNA. It has its own life to live. And then I go, why don't these obvious facts about animal life also apply to unborn human beings? And one guy writes back, he goes, Dinesh, you very cleverly picked a puppy in the late term stage, you know, and his point being that I'm somehow appealing to emotions by showing a puppy that is sort of almost delivered. And my point is, don't the left want abortion for all 9 months of pregnancy? Isn't there, if you look at their law that's supposed to codify Roe versus Wade, does it basically say we only want abortion for like the first 3 months and then not after that? No. They want to have abortion rights until the moment of birth. Maybe even after, but we won't go into that. At least up to the point of birth. And so it's completely valid to post a picture of a puppy and say, listen, if you can see that that's a puppy, and that puppy in that sense is no less a puppy than an unborn child is a child in the process of development, of course. But hey, a one-year-old is also in the process of development. So the idea that this is something that can be casually tossed aside, I think this is the heart of the pro-life debate. It's never good when the nation's supposed authority on economic policy completely misses the flashing red lights of impending inflation. Now, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has finally admitted, quote, there have been unanticipated and large shocks to the economy that have boosted energy and food prices and supply bottlenecks that affected our economy badly that I didn't, at the time, fully understand. You know who understood the real threat of inflation? Well, people like me who invested in gold and silver with Birch Gold Group. They're protecting their savings from a highly turbulent economy by diversifying their 401k or IRA into gold, physical gold. And it's not too late for you to take action now. Text Dinesh to 989898 and get a free information kit on diversifying and protecting your savings with precious metals. With an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau, countless five-star reviews, thousands of satisfied customers, including me and Debbie, Birch Gold is the place to be. Text Dinesh to 989898 and get real advice from Birch Gold today. I want to talk about another important case recently decided by the Supreme Court that has been a little sidelined because of the big decisions on gun rights, the big decisions on praying on the football field, and of course the biggest decision of all, the decision, the Dodd decision regarding that overturned Roe versus Wade. The case I want to talk about is called Berger versus North Carolina State Conference of the NAACP. And here's what's going on in that case. It's a voter ID case. So North Carolina passed a law basically saying that you need to have voter ID. You can't vote without proper ID. And this is now being contested in court, the voter ID law. But as it so happens, the Secretary of State, the Attorney General of North Carolina is a Democrat. He's opposed to voter ID. And so in a kind of irony, you got the NAACP suing to get rid of voter ID. And by the way, think of how ridiculous this is. This is the NAACP basically saying that blacks don't know how to get ID. These are the same blacks, by the way, that travel on a plane and get ID, make doctor's appointments and show their ID, open bank accounts and show their ID. But somehow when it comes to vote, they don't know how to get an ID. And so an ID requirement becomes somehow racist. It becomes discriminatory. It becomes, quote, voter suppression. I mean, is requiring you to show ID at the TSA travel suppression? When the bank says, show me your ID before you cash a check, is that banking suppression? Nonsense. But in any event, you have this case. The NAACP wants to get rid of voter ID. And the NAACP is counting on the Attorney General of North Carolina, a Democrat, to be on their side. Now, he's supposed to be defending the law, but he doesn't agree with the law. And so the point is he's going to make, it's almost like a prosecutor who wants the guy who's accused to get off. And so what is he going to do? He's going to put on a really bad case. He's going to put on a bad case so the jury goes, well, maybe the guy didn't do it. So he'll withhold evidence that is incriminating. Why? Because he doesn't agree with the prosecution. He doesn't want to go forward. And that's what's going on here. And so the Republicans basically step in and go, listen, we want to be able to file briefs that support voter ID because we don't believe that the Democratic Attorney General is going to do a good job defending a law that was in fact passed by a Republican legislature. So that was the issue. And so earlier, lower court judges had said to the Republicans, you don't know, you can't intervene here. It's the job of the Democratic Attorney General to defend voter ID. If he does a bad job, he does a bad job, but it is his job. And so the question here, we went before the Supreme Court, is simply this. Do the Republicans who have an interest in the law, they passed the law, have the right to be able to weigh in on the case? They can't displace the Democratic Attorney General, but they can file briefs that say to the court, here are our reasons for why voter ID is a good idea. And the Supreme Court goes, yes. They can do that. You can't prevent them from doing that. In other words, the whole idea here is that our legal process is adversary. By adversary, we mean that we have people on opposing sides, and they have to genuinely be on opposing sides. It makes no sense to say, let's have an adversary process. We have two guys who both agree, but one's going to pretend to be on this side, and the other's going to be, in fact, on the other side. That's not a real adversary process, because the first guy who's pretending is actually on the side of the other guy. So he can, in a sense, almost you may say, take the fall or lose and go put on a kind of, you know, put on a show, but not a real argument. And then you have a corrupted process because the idea is for the judge and the jury to hear the best arguments on both sides so that the arguments can kind of, you can weigh them almost like in a weighing scale and decide which one is better, which one is more weighty in a very literal way. And so the Supreme Court basically said, listen, that this is a law that is passed legitimately through a democratic process. The Attorney General appears to be unenthusiastic about defending it, but regardless of whether he is or not, the Republicans who passed the law have every right to step into the process and do their part to convince the judicial proceeding underway that they have a right to be heard. And by the way, this was a very interesting case because it has only a sole dissenter. Stephen Breyer and Elena Kagan joined with the conservatives. So this is not one of those 5-4 decisions or one of those decisions that was, it's 8-1. 8-1, the court decided that it's perfectly legitimate for the Republican legislature to step in here and at least to be heard. I love the 4th of July, don't we all? It's time to reflect on how blessed we are to live in this amazing country. Well, one way you can celebrate is by joining AMAC, the Association of Mature American Citizens. Membership to AMAC affords you benefits like travel and cell phone discounts, special insurance programs. What's more, it's patriotic because your membership supports causes that help preserve liberty. AMAC's Action Advocacy Team takes the fight to Capitol Hill every day, representing the concerns of true patriots like you. For just $16 a year, you can join AMAC, like Debbie and I have, and help keep our beloved America free. Go to AMAC, that's AMAC.us/Dinesh to sign up. By joining AMAC, you'll join forces with over 2.3 million other freedom-loving AMAC members and help save America for your children and grandchildren. So say happy birthday, America, and go to AMAC.us/Dinesh to become an AMAC member now. Guys, I'm really happy to welcome to the podcast John Stadden. He's a James Duke Professor of Psychology and Professor of Biology Emeritus at Duke University. He's published over 200 research papers, 9 books. We're going to talk about his latest book, Science in an Age of Unreason. It's just out. It's published by Regnery. And Professor Stadden, welcome to the podcast. Thank you for joining me. Let me begin by just asking you a little bit about your work as a scientist and as a psychologist. What is your sort of area of interest? And talk about what your role is in the science community.
Okay, well, I've been a researcher most of my life. I always wanted to be a biologist, but because of the rigidities of the British educational system, I wound up in psychology. So that's how I got into a more biological side of it. My work is experiment. I've done my research life with experiments on learning in animals, particularly timing behavior. So my idea of what's true comes from that tradition. I think you have to test something with an experiment, ideally, to be sure that it's true. I've always been interested in experimental method. I remember as a kid, as an undergraduate in London, when I was first introduced to doing experiments, it was always with groups. And I couldn't understand why. If you're interested in individual organism, why would you study a group? Well, now we sort of know. The reason is, it's a kind of algorithmic method that guarantees some sort of results. Unfortunately, as John Ioannidis showed, several years ago, most of the results produced by this method turn out to be false. That was the title of his paper, Why Most Research Results Are False. So that's one entree, if you like, in my interest in all of this. I wrote a book on experimental method a couple of years ago. I've written essays on various aspects of science over the years, and I collected them all into a more or less coherent book. I can tell you, if you like, what the different sections of the book do, but perhaps I should pass it back to you, give you a chance.
Well, say something. Yeah, you titled this book Science in an Age of Unreason, and let's talk a little bit about science is always claim the mantle of speaking in the language of reason. Am I right that science in that sense claims to be, at its best anyway, free of prejudice, free of sort of ideological doctrine? Science claims to be something, in a sense, pure. And yet you link the word science with an age of unreason. Is it that your argument is that science itself is clean, but we are bringing to science a whole set of ideological contaminations that are forcing science to do something it's not supposed to do? Where does the problem come from?
Well, I mean, there are a lot of examples. Going back into history, David Hume was one of my heroes, an 18th century Enlightenment philosopher, pointed out that there's a distinction between fact and value, and other people have echoed this over the years. So if somebody tells you a fact, it doesn't tell you what to do about the fact. Another way to put it is that science, which is a collection of facts, is like a map. It's not a destination on the map. The destination has to come from elsewhere. And that distinction has been absolutely blurred. I mean, I've just been reading and sort of complaining about an editorial in the journal Nature, which is one of the two top scientific journals, which argues, in fact, that science is itself racist, which is grotesque, absolutely grotesque. They want to, quote, decolonize science. But science is nothing but demonstrable truth. And it's really, really dangerous to mix these two things up, because the result is the scientific facts, which you don't like, for example, that there are cognitive differences between different groups, racial groups particularly, the facts that you don't like are simply dismissed. I mean, you're not allowed to study that anymore. And that is the death of, absolutely the death of science, and that's what's been happening. Another thing, I'll get into the book a little bit, the first part of the book deals with secular humanism and religion, secular humanism and religion. I wrote a little article, a little blog, I think it was in Quillette or something, years ago, which pointed out that there are really two aspects to religion. There's the belief part, the supernatural, certain aspects of history, and so on and so on, and the moral part, the part that tells you what to do. And it's really only the moral part that connects with the law. I mean, you can believe in fairies, as long as it doesn't affect, your actions don't matter, right? And my point was, if you look at secular humanism, it also has rules of action, morals and so on. And my point was, they, from the secular humanist point of view, they are as unfounded, just as unfounded as the morals of religion, right? The morals of religion are tied to things that the secular humanists don't believe in, you know, God, the Trinity, whatever it might be. But the beliefs, the moral beliefs of secular humanists are tied to nothing at all. That doesn't make them any more certain than religious beliefs. Well, just got one secular humanist very upset, an evolutionary biologist, and he wrote a rebuttal called The Article Terrible and so on and so on and so on, which I thought was almost humor, almost funny, because it seems so obvious. Anyway, all of this should have legal implications. In other words, somebody who has a secular humanist belief in something, you know, pro-abortion, anti-abortion, whatever it might be, should have no different standing than a religious person who has similar objections. I mean, they're equally unprovable by the methods of science. So that's the first bit of the book. The next one goes into Darwin, which a lot of secular humanists really almost think gives you a moral system. I don't think it does, for the Humean reason. And I talk about a very contentious area, which is climate change. I got a couple of chapters on climate change. These were at the behest of a colleague of mine, a brilliant fellow, a physicist, engineer, who was very skeptical of the scientific argument for CO2 as a kind of knob on the climate. I wasn't all that interested at first. I was intrigued because of the violent resistance that's offered by the climate people if you question them. Freeman Dyson, great, you know, Freeman Dyson is what, he died recently. Wonderful, a wonderful physicist, very brilliant guy, and he made the same point. Why are these climate change people so sensitive? Why are they so sensitive? I mean, if you were to come to a flat earther were to approach you and say, "I don't believe the earth is flat. Tell me your evidence for why it's round," you'd be happy to give it, right? You explain to experiments have been done, the season, the daily change in the sun's position, blah, blah, blah. You can give all the reasons. I doubt that many people who believe in a global, a spherical earth would get upset. They might be amused, but they wouldn't get mad. You know, they wouldn't get mad. But the climate people get mad. Anyway, my colleague.
Let's take a pause, Professor Stan. Let's take a pause. We'll be right back after the break and pick right up on this.
Okay.
Some of us wish we could rewind the clock when it comes to our health. Exercising, climbing stairs, all the things young people take for granted. Well, these aren't things that have to stop just because you get older. Neither do you have to endure and suffer the normal aging aches and pains. Now, there's a 100% drug-free solution. It's called Relief Factor. Relief Factor supports your body's fight against inflammation. That's the source of aches and pains. The vast majority of people who try Relief Factor order more because it works for them. Debbie's a true believer. She's excited. She finally gets to do her bar exercise class now that she's alleviated a frozen shoulder thanks to relief factor. Debbie knows if she stops taking it, well, the pain could come right back. So she's like, I don't want to be without this again. You too can benefit. Try it for yourself. Order the 3-week quick start for the discounted price of just $19.95. Go to relieffactor.com or call 833-690-7246 to find out more about this offer. That number again, 833-690-7246, or call or go to relieffactor.com. You'll feel the difference. I'm back with John Stanton, the author of Science in an Age of Unreason. Professor Stanton, let me pick up on something you said a few moments ago. You were talking about religion, and you were talking about secular humanism. And did I understand you correctly to say that, you know, religious people would freely admit that their propositions of, let's say, revelation or even of morality to some degree derive from faith? Faith is clearly a key aspect of certainly Christian and probably other religious belief as well. And I took you to be saying that you've got these secular humanists and they've got this elaborate moral superstructure themselves. They have themselves contested moral beliefs, but they somehow think that those beliefs are fortified by reason. They have some more solid standing than the beliefs of religious people. And you're saying that's not true, that secular humanism itself is a kind of religious system. Not religious in that it has a, quote, theology, but it is religious in the sense that it has its own morality, and that is no more automatically derived from facts than anybody else's morality.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, the morality of secular humanists doesn't come from nowhere. It comes from people like John Stuart Mill, philosophers, maybe Spinoza, I don't know, John Rawls, you know, a theory of justice guy. It comes from somewhere, but it is not provable by the methods of science. It's not testable by the method. It does depend on faith. It just happens to be a secular faith rather than a religious one, and no better or no worse for that. In other words, the idea that some secular humanists have that they're somehow above the fray, you know, that their beliefs are not grounded in these silly superstitions, is actually wrong. I mean, yeah. What you have to compare is not the, quote, superstitious beliefs of the religious people versus the lack of such beliefs by the secular humanists. What you have to compare is what their recommendations for behavior actually are. I have to admit, part of my history is behaviorism. I was very critical of the radical behaviorism of B.F. Skinner. I've written several editions of a book called The New Behaviorism, which goes into all the differences. But the bottom line is, I think for science, it's third person accessible behavior that matters. And the behavior of the secular humanist is as ungrounded in reason as the behavior of the religious people. They all depend on faith. They all depend on faith. And that, in a way, ought to be philosophically obvious. And it ought to remove any kind of legal distinction between the faith of religious people and the faith of secular humanists. And I guess the recent Supreme Court thing about this guy praying at the on the center line of the field, that he was allowed to do that. Fine, why not? Why not? I mean, teachers every day indoctrinate their kids with secular humanist beliefs, which are matters of just as much of faith as this poor chap was praying in his football field.
You mentioned in the book both Richard Dawkins, and you mentioned also Sam Harris, and you mentioned these two guys as thinking that somehow they can derive values out of facts. In other words, they seem to think that their value propositions are nothing more than reconstructed factual propositions. And these are, by the way, two guys who would claim to be disciples of Hume. And yet you point out that Hume draws a sharp distinction between a fact and a value, and that a fact is something that is, and a value is something that, in someone's opinion, ought to be the case. I think the reason this is fundamental, and I'd like you to elaborate briefly on it, is that if you take something like COVID, you have facts. These are the facts that we know about the virus. But out of that, you can debate what we should do. In other words, should we have mask mandates or vaccine mandates? Should we shut the economy down or shut it down partially and for how long? And I think what you're saying is that those are prudential judgments and one cannot simply, you know, say, listen to the science as if the science itself tells you what to do.
I think you're dead right. I mean, it's like follow the science is nonsense. It's again, it's like saying follow a map. Well, you need a destination before you follow a map. I'm a nasty example of that. Well, there are two things to be said about. One is medical conditions are only one thing a politician must take account of. There are medical risks, there are health risks, but there are other risks we all know about, the stress on the economy and so on and so on. So, a medical person should never have hegemony. I mean, he should give advice, right? And then the political system, which can take account of other variables, it should make the final decision. That seems pretty obvious. The other point is, again, to underline what you said, your morals determine what you should do. So initially, when the vaccines were scarce, a lot of people said, well, we should give them to the most vulnerable people, right? Old people, people with comorbidities, and so on and so on. But another person who was a Darwinian, a evil social Darwinian, could say, well, no, they're the least valuable people to society. They should be the last. Let them die first, you know. So, well, thank goodness we didn't have a lot of such people. But it's to show that the science by itself does not tell you what to do.
Let's take a pause, Professor Staden. When we come back, let's probe a little further the scientific method.
Imagine the lifelong impact of a journey to the Holy Land. Surrounded by like-minded travelers, picture yourself stepping foot in iconic locations right out of Scripture. Join Dr. Sebastian Gorka and Dinesh D'Souza on this life-enriching Israel tour, November 30th through December 9th, 2022. For more information, call 855-565-5519 or visit standwithisraeltour.com.
I'm back with Professor John Staden. We're talking about his book, Science in an Age of Unreason. And Professor Staden, you've made the point that science is a set of facts, a kind of map, and one can choose one's destination in terms of where one wants to go with that map. Now, there's emerged, I think, mainly from the left, and particularly on issues like race, like gender, the argument that science is not a kind of neutral or objective map. It's a map that's made by certain types of people, and I think you know the rhetoric here. These are going to be the sort of despised white males who have been in charge for so long. They decided the questions to investigate. They formulated the hypotheses. They created their map, whereas presumably a different map could be drawn that asks different types of questions. How would you address this question that somehow science is the particular product of a particular culture and has smuggled in prejudices that are not publicly acknowledged?
Well, it's a powerful argument. I mean, I won't say powerful, I'll say persuasive. It's a persuasive argument. I say a couple of things. One is that a thread running through these critics is to deny objectivity. I've read several of these of the race people who say that objectivity is a I don't know what you call it, a chimera. It's something we should not believe in. We should not believe in objectivity. Sorry, my phone.
That's okay. Keep going.
We should not believe in objectivity. And obviously, nobody is objective. The whole point about science is that it's trial and error. You try hypotheses, and sometimes they work and sometimes they don't. But error is a huge part of it. So the way to the answer, I guess, to these people who say that it's all white Europeans or something like that. So it's, well, you come in, you come up with your own hypotheses and see how that works. The method is neutral. And usually what they do is retreat into incomprehensible verbiage. I mean, I just was listening to a webcast by a professor, I think she was at Brown University, on systemic racism. And she did at least come up with a definition for systemic racism, but it's inscrutable. There's nothing you can measure in it. It's just a reference to, you know, vague things. I could even read it to you if we had more time, but there's nothing in it which is testable. So it's outside of science, but it is in the realm of propaganda and persuasion. Human beings are fallible. It's possible to persuade them by subtly injecting values that they're sensitive to, and they'll believe things which are not testable. So it's ridiculous to say that science is white European. Science is about testable ideas. It's about testable ideas. They can come from anywhere. Maybe the supply is restricted because any Europeans or whatever did it. Well, okay, supplement it with your own.
Yeah, I think what you're saying, and let me give an example to try to apply it, is I think what you're saying is that there are demonstrable things that one can measure that are true. Let's take, for example, that men are taller than women or men are stronger than women. This is a fact. Now, it's not a fact about every individual man or woman. You could find a particular woman, of course, but on average, there are important differences between men and women. And similarly, if you look at ethnic groups and you look, for example, at math tests, for example, you do find that there are ethnic differences. I think there's been a debate now for some decades about why this is the case. What I found remarkable about your book is that there are lots of people who deny it is the case. And so they begin with a flat-out denial of the fact instead of attempting to do a reasonable understanding of why these facts come to be. And this is what you're talking about in the attack on objectivity. They act as if the very claim that there's a biological difference between men and women, or that men are stronger than women, which of course would then provide a basis for things like men's sports and women's sports. And of course, there's room to argue. But what you're saying is they are attacking not just the values, they're attacking the facts.
Well, I confess I'm really baffled by it. I mean, I've just been reading this Nature editorial written by four people of color, I guess you'd have to say. And they seem unable to grasp the distinction between the fact and what you should do about it. They seem unable to grasp that a fact is just a fact, and Nature, which is a scientific magazine, deals only in fact, and Nature has given them permission to write these editorials, basically racializing everything. I mean, it's utterly grotesque. I am rendered silent by the absurdity of the whole thing. It really is quite remarkable.
Well, whether you're rendered silent or not, you have eloquently stated the argument in your book, which I recommend to people, Science in an Age of Unreason. Hey, Professor Stanton, thank you very much for joining me. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Dinesh. I hope we get together again.
Subscribe to the Dinesh D'Souza podcast on Apple, Google, and Spotify, or watch on Rumble, YouTube, and SalemNow.com. Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never before seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.